Welcome to episode 51 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I am a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I'm talking to Jana Morgan, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Tennessee, and also right now visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. She works on inequality, exclusion, and representation, and she explores how economic, social, and political inequalities affect marginalized groups and undermine democratic processes and outcomes. So, Jana, thank you so much for taking some time.
Thanks for having me.
So, what we're going to talk about today is that you recently published an article in Latin American Research Review on political decentralization and party decay in Latin America. That's actually the title. And I should note, too, for those non-academics out there who are listening to this, is that Latin American Research Review is one of the top journals in Latin American studies, is open access. So you can go and look at this right now, which is, I think, a really cool thing that Laura's doing.
Yeah, it's a new initiative, and it's really great, I think, for getting your research out there and letting practitioners read it as well as scholars.
Yeah, and they were doing some people had done like kind of blog posty stuff. Were you doing that for them too?
So they invite all authors to submit a blog post that sort of summarizes some of the main arguments and kind of makes some applied ideas, take some applied ideas from the argument. And so they invited me to do that. I've written that post, and I think they're just kind of they dribble them out over a period of time after the issue comes out. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Now the first question is. The first question I'm going to ask that I had to ask of everybody that I first talked to is, what originally got you interested in studying Latin American politics?
I think that's a great question. For me, it's a sort of personal story. My parents actually lived in Peru. They worked at an international school there on the edge of the Amazon jungle back in the 1970s before I was born. And they lived there for a few years. And when I was a kid growing up, I never got to visit there as a child. But growing up, I heard all kinds of great stories of their time living there in the jungle. Most kids, when they go to kindergarten show and tell, bring their stuffed animals. And I got to bring the teeth from the crocodile that my dad had hunted when he was living on the Amazon. So there was a lot of sort of lore, family stories, even old slideshows that we would watch as kids. So it was a sort of romanticized view, obviously, of Latin America that, you know, any kid might have. But I had this sort of real interest in it, just instilled in me because of those stories. And then in middle school and high school, I started learning Spanish and decided in college to study Spanish as one of my majors and got a chance to actually travel to some different places in Latin America. When I was a sophomore in college, I went and did my first extended study abroad in Mexico City and lived with a lower middle class family and shared the only bed in their home with their 16-year-old daughter. So it was a real, not your typical study abroad experience. I have not spoken to any other friends who studied abroad and had that sort of living arrangement as college sophomores. So I think that experience sort of helped me to begin to see kind of the difference between what we think of when we kind of have a caricature of Latin America as opposed to what Latin America is really like for ordinary citizens. And that's always been something that's motivated me in my work, is just trying to understand the ways in which ordinary Latin American citizens experience politics and try to influence the state in ways that can bring them better lives.
Okay, that's really interesting because, I have somewhat similar kind of story. I don't have the crocodile teeth or anything like that. but like studying Spanish was my entree. And now I also didn't. I studied abroad, but I was living in a college dorm. So I was definitely not getting the type of experience you were. But it's always fascinating to me to hear what people say. There's all these different paths that people have taken to studying Latin America, and then even just the politics part. None of no two are alike.
Yeah, for me, I was always interested in history and politics generally, and so and then seeing kind of social and political inequalities as a student just really helped me kind of connect those dots together.
Right. So thinking about your paper, and there's various kind of angles that I thought were interesting, but to kind of get the ball rolling and to get the right context, so what was the original intent and the promise of the decentralization projects in Latin America?
You know, I would say that the original intent was twofold. And the first was really a positive kind of promise, as you said it. It was to bring government closer to the people, to try to make it more accountable and responsive, especially to local issues and concerns. And the idea was basically to give people more oversight, to give, to push government to be more transparent in its decision-making processes. And the basic idea was that proximity would facilitate these kinds of goals more readily than distant governments in national capitals. And so the idea was really a positive one of building up stronger ties between people and government. The other intention, I think, was really more of an attempt to tear down something that had come to be perceived as bad rather than building up something positive. And there, neoliberal reformers often saw large centralized states in the developing world as mired in corruption and inefficiency, as being overly activist and interventionist. And they wanted a more lean state with less power and oftentimes fewer resources. And so decentralization was one of the tools that neoliberal reformers used to achieve this goal. And so in this way, decentralization really sought to deconstruct the state apparatus politically, just like neoliberal economic reforms like privatization sought to deconstruct the state economically. So there was kind of a positive promise, and then also sort of an attempt to deal with what was perceived to be a problem.
Right. And so one of the things you talk about is unintended consequences. So just give an overview of what your argument is for why and under what conditions decentralization hurts parties.
Yeah, so I think that negative reaction against what was perceived to be weaknesses of the Latin American state was oftentimes also thought of as weaknesses of Latin American parties, that they were corrupt or clientelist, and that decentralization would kind of break apart clientelist networks and encourage parties to be more responsive. But I think ultimately what happened with decentralization was that it increased costs and reduced resources that were available to existing national party apparatuses. So parties that had been accustomed to competing exclusively in national contests suddenly were opened up to competition at the subnational level, and they were having to compete now not just in, you know, national races every few years, but having to compete in dozens or hundreds, in some countries even thousands, of subnational elections. And so they were stretched thin, and because their party organizational structures were not really adapted to that type of competition. And they were facing new challengers at the subnational level. And so there were all kinds of new entrants into party systems as a result of the decentralization process. And so this was costly organizationally for parties because they had to figure out how to adapt to these subnational contests. It was also financially costly for them because they had to compete and develop you know, locally or regionally articulated campaigns and strategies. They had to recruit candidates at the subnational level. So there were a lot of additional costs associated with the political decentralization. And so this posed a challenge for all political parties. But lots of parties were able to effectively adapt to the decentralization challenge, provided that they didn't encounter two basic contextual conditions. So the contextual conditions that made it challenging for parties to survive the decentralization threat were having a poorly performing economy, Or having political parties that were primarily clientelist in their orientation. So, if parties confronted the organizational and financial challenges of decentralization when the economy was performing poorly, it was much more difficult for them to generate the economic resources that they needed to compete at the subnational level. And if parties were reliant on primarily clientelist exchanges as opposed to more policy-based appeals, those decentralized contests were especially costly to them because they now could no longer rely on a single clientelist exchange in a one national election, but rather were having to produce clientelist benefits repeatedly to win elections at the various levels of government. So programmatic parties were better. So programmatic parties are parties that provide some sort of policy-based appeal. Those parties were much better adapted to competing at the subnational level because programmatic appeals are not increased in cost just because you have another election, whereas clientelist appeals do become more costly when you add more elections. So when decentralization occurred in context of a poorly performing economy, or when clientelism was the primary form of connection between parties and voters, then existing national party apparatuses declined in power. And so
Okay.
it's really the combination of the decentralization and those contextual conditions which pose the threat to established parties.
And here's sort of a side question I think would be that is one that's relevant actually for a lot of the world, and that is, so why do we care about parties? Like, why do we care about the major parties? Why should we anyway?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's something that I've thought about a lot in my work. And I think that there are a couple of different ways that you can think about that. I think the most obvious one is that you can point to examples of places where traditional party systems have decayed or collapsed, and the subsequent kind of what comes to replace those collapsed systems is. To my, there may be the occasional exception to this, but to my evaluation, is almost uniformly less effective as a system of interest articulation than what it replaced. So, if you think about the Venezuelan party system's collapse and what came afterward, there are some benefits to be gained by introducing new competitors into the system, but it also creates uncertainty, volatility, increased conflict. The Italian party system is another instance of party system collapse where decentralization contributed. That's not in the article that's published in LAR, but this is another case where you have traditional political parties that decay and it's replaced by much more personalist, less programmatic forms of competition. So, what parties do essentially is they provide organized voice and interest articulation into the political system. And even clientelist parties do that to some extent. And when established organizations disappear, then the opportunities for interest articulation, for accountability, also disappear.
Yeah, and I think that a good point here too is that parties have all kinds of problems, and certainly clientelist parties do, but they are less bad than many of the alternatives.
Exactly. And I think it's important to point out that when clientelist parties decayed due to decentralization, they weren't typically replaced by programmatic parties, right?
Right.
They were replaced by other clientelists, but just more disarticulated and less organized clientelist entities or purely personalist vehicles, right? So we can
Right.
think about parties that are named after individuals like, the Fujimoristas in Peru, right? These are not programmatic actors in any sense of the word.
Right. Now, I'm thinking of personalized politics. So thinking counterfactually, if there had been less decentralization in Venezuela, so Venezuela is one of the cases you use, would it likely have mattered much? So in some of these places, we see there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the traditional parties. already. So, like, how do we judge, how do we untangle that of how much it mattered or what would have happened anyway?
Yeah, I do want to be clear that my argument in the paper is not that decentralization causes party systems to collapse, nor is it that decentralization is the only factor that contributes to party decay. But I was
Yeah, fair
mostly
enough.
interested in trying to understand, what role decentralization might have played in the decay of traditional parties across the region. And so I would argue that decentralization served to accelerate the demise of the traditional parties in Venezuela.
Okay.
So what essentially happened in Venezuela, and this is an argument that I make in my book about, it's called Bankrupt Representation and Party System Collapse, which examines the Venezuelan case in depth as well as several other instances of party system failure. And my argument there is that party systems are able to survive when they're able to provide linkage to citizens, to a broad swath of the citizenry. And what happened in Venezuela is that during the 1980s and 1990s, each of the strategies that Venezuelan parties had traditionally employed to attract voters deteriorated. So it isn't just that they encountered decentralization and they were no longer able to deliver clientelism, but also that they had converged programmatically and on a single, basically by the mid to late 1990s, the two major parties are completely overlapping each other ideologically. Even the traditional party of the left was located in a similar spot on the ideological spectrum by the late 1990s. They were all in coalitions with each other, and they had failed to respond effectively to the economic crisis. So, in terms of policy, the parties were not offering effective representation to basically anybody who wasn't on the right. In addition to that, the sort of traditional kind of group-based appeals that the parties had made around the sort of worker-owner cleavage. So one party had represented workers' interests, the others had represented sort of more business interests. That cleavage lost salience in the 1990s as the formal sector of the economy shrank and the informal sector grew, and it became a formal-informal divide that was sort of the most salient social divide in Venezuelan society. And all of the traditional parties were located on the side of representing the formal sector interests. So you see, for example, once the traditional parties fail, that the National Centralized Union of Venezuela and the National Business Organization started marching together to protest the Chavista government, right? That is sort of the most obvious example of the way in which the sort of formal interests became coalesced into a single unit and informal sector interests were completely left out in the cold. So this all basically happens during the late 1980s and 1990s, when then decentralization begins to pick up speed and threatens the only remaining form of linkage, which is clientelism. So once programmatic appeals and group-based appeals deteriorate, clientelism becomes the only game in town. And that is the form of linkage that decentralization most directly attacks. And so those reforms undermined sort of the last remaining thread of survival that the traditional parties had and cut it off.
And one thing you were just mentioning is how in Venezuela the two parties really seem to overlap. And this was one of the things in your article that I pondered a good amount, and that is that you say that some level of partisan polarization is actually good for parties. So how at what point does it become a problem, right? Because how do you balance some amount of differentiation with polarization that causes conflict?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the referent there is you can think about the current situation in the United
See,
States, or you
and
can.
I totally was. That was yeah. Unfortunately, when I was
Yeah, but
reading this, I
there.
kept going thinking of the US.
But I think there are even Latin American examples of that where you have such acrimony that governability becomes a
I mean,
problem.
how about Chile in the late 60s, early 70s?
So there you, and so I think what is important, what happened in Venezuela was the complete collapsing of any programmatic differentiation. And where I think polarization becomes problematic isn't when, I think that we should have, a little bit more government intervention here and you think there should be a little bit less, but rather it becomes problematic when we're fighting over the very sort of fundamental construct of what society should be about, right? So I think when you have polarization that isn't around policy issues, but actually becomes about norms of the way that society should be constructed or about the way politics should be constructed, that that type of polarization is problematic. So drawing an example from Venezuela, where of course you have extreme polarization today, along with lots of other problems, one of the things that I've found in some recent work is showing that in the old days, when the traditional parties offered programmatic options, they were offering kind of different versions of the same basic agreed upon structure for the economy and society, right? Today, when the opposition and the government in Venezuela are arguing about the direction that we should take, it's not about should we have more or less government or should the state be more or less separated from the church or whatever. It's instead about do we think elections are really free and fair? Do we really think that we should value civil rights and liberties, or should we value social equality more, right? So we're talking about really fundamental points of contestation about how we think the best society should be structured, not just policy competition. And I think when we start having those arguments about what is the basic logic of our political structure, that's when the polarization becomes damaging for the fabric of politics and society.
Yeah, and I mean, and honestly, that answers almost the last question, because I was going to ask you about the, can this be applied to the United States? But what you're saying right now, that really is the application, or that's the application anywhere, is what are you arguing about?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think, that sometimes people in the US misunderstand what's happening about what there's a critique of polarization, and says, well, why can't we all just get along? And why can't we just, work together? And there are certain areas in which you want to have everyone working together. You want a sort of consensus around the rules of the game. But if everyone in power all thinks the same thing, then different interests aren't being represented. And so I'm always cautious to sort of tell to my friends who study US politics and bemoan polarization, or sort of ordinary citizens who bemoan polarization, to say it's actually good to have policy differences and ideological differences as long as we're all starting from a shared understanding of how we play the political game.
Right. And of course, in the US, it's a similar thing to, say, Venezuela, where for a long time people were saying the parties are too similar. And now it's like, oh, the parties are too different.
Right. And I would argue that the US parties are similar on certain issues where it's beneficial to them. I've actually got another research project about the US that argues that there's part of that project argues that there's been a collapsing of polarization within the US party system around certain issues. So thinking about things like about financial deregulation, for example, where basically Democrats and Republicans don't take super different, except for the maybe occasional person like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. For the most part, most Democrats and Republicans don't take super different positions on those types of issues, but they do still take different positions on other types of policy issues. So we have some collapsing of polarization around certain kinds of issues. And then the maintenance of a policy divide in other areas.
Yeah, and I mean, this was colored too, because I was at the same time reading How Democracies Die.
Ah, yeah.
And so that's like, So now I read about Latin America, and since, of course, with Stephen Levitsky using Latin America examples, then I'm suddenly I keep comparing everything to the United States. Probably not good for my mental health.
No. I think they wrote that book so that they would be able to have a way to process their challenges with their mental health, thinking about all this stuff.
I
So.
you could totally read that as like sort of a self-soothing sort of thing. Of
Yeah.
just and trying to show some hope that there is at least some hope.
Exactly.
Okay, with that, we are out of time. I've been talking to Jana Morgan, who's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Tennessee and a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. So, Jana, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it.